No, sometimes I just burst in all sorts of ways. It's because Gabriella Peralta's poorly in Gibraltar. Oh dear, get well soon, Gabriella. Anyway, highs of 18 degrees centigrade, lows of 11 degrees centigrade today. It's going to be a day of heavy rain and sharp breezes. Sharp breezes. Blustery. A blustery day in all sorts of other wonderful ways there. Stephanie Romoshevsky, what's the weather like in the southwest of England?
Pretty much the same. It looks pretty gloomy outside, very grey.
But you bring sunshine to the whole thing, so that's important. So good news from that point of view. And so does Ellie Sample, our Director of Communications, and much, much more at the University of Lincoln. Isn't that right, Ellie?
Hello, Alex. Very jolly and very happy to be here. Hello, Stephanie. Hello, Ben.
Hello.
Oh, you see me. You can see Ellie sort of just brings that joyous habit. It's like a Lincolnshire puppy come to life. It's awesome. Ben, you've just spent the last year working at Bentley Motors, doing a placement as part of the degree programme, etc. So you've done that. Did you have any challenges sleeping at all?
I think I did, some regard, yeah. I think it's, you've always got to get a work-life balance, don't get me wrong. But I think sometimes you need to learn to switch off when you come home. And a lot of the time I perhaps didn't, where you end up. Then it kind of disrupts your sleeping pattern, I think.
And Ellie, you always strike me as a person who's full on 100% of the time. What's your own kind of... Do you feel, as the Sleepy Head Clinic line says, that you've tried everything? Do you struggle to stay asleep? Does sleep affect you at all?
I struggle really badly. I have a hyperactive thyroid, so I don't sleep very much at all. I get up most days about 5:30, and I walk the dog at 6:00, and... I'm quite lucky in a way in that I don't need sleep so much, but I have tried everything from hypnotherapy to drugs.
But not Channel 4's official sleep doctor, Stephanie Romoshevsky.
No, not the official sleep doctor.
You see, Stephanie, once again, in these wonderful fortnightly Sleepy Head Clinic slots, we bring the people in need of your advice and wisdom.
You're saying I'm sickly?
No. Stephanie, who would you like to consider first, the case of Ben or indeed Ellie?
Maybe Ellie first, just because I remember that one quicker.
Short-term memory sometimes goes. Is it lack of sleep, Steph?
My memory's terrible. I think something you said is really important, Ellie. You said, I don't think I need much sleep anyway. And actually, that's really good to know, because a lot of us will really stress and worry that we're not getting what we feel should be the amount that we get. So actually, that's fantastic that you have that kind of outlook on it. Getting up early and getting up at the same time every day is really, really good for us. In fact, I've just been speaking to someone about the quality of their sleep and how they're just feeling a little bit like some odd stuff happens in their sleep, like they might, grind their teeth or just extra moving around, and generally just not feeling like the quality of their sleep is good enough. And on sort of investigation, what I found was he's spending a lot of time in bed, but not sleeping. And actually, my idea to help was to actually make sure he has a really regular wake time, but actually restrict the amount of time he's spending in bed. He doesn't have to, if it's taking him over 30 minutes to get to bed, to get to sleep, then maybe go to bed 30 minutes later, just in the short term, just to build that quality back up. And you're absolutely right. There's so many conditions out there that affect our sleep, and sleep affects so many conditions. But there are still things that we can do to improve the quality of our sleep. And one of them is getting up early at the same time every day and getting as much light as possible, which, of course, in our country at the moment is not great because we don't have much light at 5:30 in the morning.
To be honest, yeah, Stephanie, I love going for a walk across the fields in the dark. I think it's gorgeous.
Oh, that's nice.
It's quite fun.
That sounds good. That sounds really lovely. And more people do need to get outside, like movement and getting out in the fresh air is just as important. But unfortunately, when people start to have poor sleep, what they feel is that it's uncontrollable. There's nothing they can do. But there are always things we can do. We just kind of look in the wrong places, like, you know, reducing caffeine. They're all the basic things that we can do. But there are so many more things we can do to regulate sleep, and most of the time we find that actually we're not being that consistent. So often the first thing I get people to look at is how consistent you are at exercise, eating and sleeping. Just look at the timings of everything, and just for a couple of weeks just be super consistent, just to see if just regulating your body slightly helps. It might not, but it's a really good place to start.
Oh, I think that's really, really good advice, and I think it's quite nice to get the endorsement that you're actually doing the right thing by getting up and doing stuff, because you are told, oh, you should be sleeping for 7 to 9 hours, and you sort of lay there tossing and turning and feeling miserable. So it's better just to get up and embrace the day.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely 100% would say that. And then go to bed when you're really sleepy, and try not to be, if you want a good quality sleep at night and it's a little bit poor, try not to do any kind of napping or anything during the day that might hinder that. But often people, as soon as things go downhill, they'll start altering the timings of their sleep properly. Perhaps they lie in a bit, perhaps they go to bed early, and then your sleep, your brain doesn't really understand that you're, you know, what you want is more, you're trying to improve the quality, but your brain sort of thinks, oh, I've got more time now, so I don't need to have this regular consistent sleep. But it's funny, our behaviors directly alter what our bodies do, but we're trying to help. It's very strange.
Ben, you've been listening to that. I'm tempted to actually refer to the Facebook Sleepyhead Clinic post, which says, people often give many excuses for why they can't stop being stressed, why they can't stop thinking and buzzing, when in reality, life is all choices. The choice may be the lesser of two evils, but we still have a choice which could be helpful. Does that resonate with your lifestyle?
Yeah, I'd say to some extent. It's I think the difficulty is, it's, you know, in what I was saying before, I think the problem I mainly have, I don't know if other people also have, is learning to switch off before going to bed. And now I've heard, obviously, quite a few things circulating around, but I obviously want to confirm with you about sort of devices before going to bed, sort of, When should you stop looking at your phone and stuff?
You should have entered the light box competition, Bernie. So,
this is the thing, something like that, you know, switching off before going to bed and actually, you know, letting your mind relax before going to sleep, as opposed to then going to bed and absolutely, you know, start spending half an hour thinking about
your day. You got your retweets, you got your Instagrams, you got your social media. Oh, Lord.
You gotta remember that actually when you put these devices on, it's like switching your brain on. Your brain remembers that the last time you were using those devices is potentially at work, at a time when you're most alert and very stimulated. So your brain, in order to try to help you, it thinks it's trying to help you, it then makes you more stimulated because it's associating that particular piece of technology, whatever you're doing, with being awake and being very alert. So your body's trying to physiologically wind down, and you're unfortunately giving it all these sort of triggers to wind up again. It could be that simple, but often when people are actually being very good with their technology and they're turning it all off and they're still wondering, why am I not able to wind down before bed? Well, that's when I would say that actually we need to go through the day here and start thinking about winding down every hour for a couple of minutes. Rather than, you know, going through our very busy lives and then a couple of hours before sleep, we expect to be able to do some magical techniques and then suddenly you can sleep well. Life just isn't like that. We need to learn to be able to deal with stress as it comes. You know, bringing back balance after, say, an hour of your day, or, you know, you go into a meeting and it's very animated. What are you going to do when you get out? Just to maintain that balance again and be able to go back to your work without constantly worrying and thinking about what you were just doing in that meeting. The more that we can get used to that, breaking the cycle of stress, the less likely you are to feel wound up before you go to bed. So there are a ton of things you can do before you go to bed to try and help wind down. But in my experience, if you want to long-term fix it, you need to start looking at the day and incorporating some sort of technique that you like a breathing technique, a relaxation technique, a meditation technique, whatever works for you. It's all different. And just see how that starts to affect your sleep.
That sounds really good advice.
See, bottom line, Ellie, is I view Stephanie Romoshevsky as being to sleep what Chris Packham is to bats. Okay? If you want to find out something about the Holsaw system, if you're interested in bats, you'd go to Chris Packham, obviously, because he is the go-to person.
I know, and he was going to be our phone-in man today. It's okay. He's on the train.
I thought that was such a weak excuse. Chris, you're going through a tunnel. Never mind.
Watch out for the bats.
Exactly. But the same way I feel, Stephanie Romoshevsky is that sort of guru when it comes to sleep, really. This is great, and, you know, wonderful stuff. Stephanie, what does the rest of the day have in store for yourself?
Well, got a few clients today, and then a few corporate clients, slightly different workshops and things like that.
Well, it's always a wonderment. And do you ever sort of hanker to get back to work with NASA and actually talk about those? I mean, I'm thinking they're still talking about the trips to Mars, etc. Any sort of thoughts you think? I think, or maybe set up a space program in Exeter. You know, that'd be worth
it. Oh, my gosh, that would be amazing. I would love that.
It
would
be sending Exeter to the moon.
Yeah.
Didn't Uri Geller try that? Surely. I mean, he bends his spoons. He looks after the football club. It's awesome. Stephanie, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
Yes, as always.
And are you going to be back with us again in a fortnight?
Yes, absolutely.
Yay! Better way when you've actually returned from Vienna to actually celebrate the joy of coming back from Vienna with the sharp ending, but the theme from Quantum of Solace, surely one of Richard Fitzwilliam's all-time favourite Bond movies. Isn't that right, Richard?
Well, Alex, you're in splendid form already. How right you are. I've forgotten how many times I saw it and compared the music to Handel.
Exactly, exactly so, and rightly so. Now, we'll do introductions. In the team, we have the fabulous Director of Communications here at the University of Lincoln. That's Ellie Sample in the studio with us.
Morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Excellent. And back after a year, although your paths crossed whilst you were playing table tennis, as I revealed to you last week, in the streets of London, because Ben Lewis was literally in the office. Were you watching him at the time, Ben?
No, I was in the office behind where Richard was playing table tennis.
He was in the office.
Not very successfully, I have to say, but it was quite fun. I've only done it once this year, but it's a lovely idea to have the boards in the different London squares, and there's a lot of entertainment. But the trouble is, of course, that if you actually remember when I was up 2 years ago and I used to play table tennis quite a lot, the problem with this is that there's a sort of unwritten rule that if you win, you can keep your position as long as you like. And that means that, you know, some very good players and you really will get transferred if you try.
So we're looking at the photograph at present, actually, Richard, of yourself holding the bat. I have to say, it's a good pose, isn't it, Ellie? I mean, that's sort of striking. There's Richard there, and his opponent looks as though he's quite... Yes, Richard in the sort of very... the effective... I mean, the traditional, in a sense, royal correspondent and midweek drive gear from that point of view. And Ben, your window was...
Number 22, just behind Richard's head.
Sort of echoes of the day of the jackal.
Now, just because we have referred to Ben as Ben Sniper Lewis in times past, it's just it's a different line. Sorry. But if you want anybody taken out, just let us know. Anyway, enough of such stuff. Let us move on. Richard, as ever, we're going to do a feature on two movies and, of course, your recent trip to Vienna. Where do you want to go to first? American Animals, The Little Stranger, or Vienna?
I think Vienna first, because it really was absolutely fascinating, because Vienna was celebrating the centenary of the deaths of two of its most famous, two of the three most famous contemporary artists. Oskar Kokoschka was the third, Gustav Klimt, and also Egon Schiele. And really, some of the exhibitions there are just amazing. Schiele was a major figurative artist, but also there was a raw intensity and sexuality about his work, and the horror of many of his paintings affected his time, and also his exploration of the nude was groundbreaking. And there's an amazing exhibition at the Leopold Museum of his work, which commemorates this 100 years. And also, they have some permanent Klimt. I mean, Gustav Klimt, I think, is part of legend because everyone knows the story of the portrait of Adele Bloch-Bahr and the subsequent court case. The Helen Mirren, of course, in the film that detailed this. And, of course, the kiss at the Belvedere, which is Judith, a glorious decadence that characterized a lot of his work, and also the use of gold leaf. It really is sensational in Austria because the three major palaces, I mean, often for a palace you go from one room to the other, and by the time you come out of it you can't remember anything you've seen. But when the case of Schönbrunn, I have to admit, despite hordes of tourists who go there with very good reason that you can't miss it and mustn't miss it, each room is created, and you can see why Maria Theresa, the Habsburg Empress, was so devoted to it. One also has to say the Hofburg is pretty spectacular. So much of it, the legend of Emperor Franz Joseph's unhappy wife Sissy, they certainly play on that. And one also has to mention the Belvedere, where there's the kiss. And
you see, this is the reason, Richard, why Chris Evans had to step aside from Radio 2. He realised he could not compete with Richard Fitzwilliam's views on Emperor Franz Joseph and the Belvedere
Sissy.
Palace. And Sissy.
Yes.
Exactly. These are the messages, and that's why long may you stay in that particular slot. I'm amazed Richard Branson hasn't already offered you a significant several million sum to several million pounds sum to actually provide that
you
support.
You would never leave us, Alex. It's you would
true.
Never leave Simon.
Loyalty is a big thing at Simon.
I still have never forgotten or forgiven Mr. Evans for the, shall we say, somewhat curt treatment he dished out to some of our fine staff within the university.
I didn't know that. I wasn't familiar with the story at all.
Ellie could, but she couldn't say anything. Yeah. It's okay, she's too good. But yes, just the sigh, just that sort of inflection. Yeah. says it all. You know, that's,
it's so weird because so many people you meet, as Ben and I were just talking about, because he's met everyone over the last year in work.
Share with us, Ben.
I wouldn't say everyone.
Go on. Do some name dropping. Faces. We need it.
Well, Richard would know one quite well. It was Prince Michael of Kent.
Hampton
Court Palace. This is a conversation. I have to say, I'm unfamiliar with the background of the story. Yeah. But
How did you encounter Prince Michael of Kent?
Funny enough, it was working in at Soho Square. He didn't come there, but
was he looking for Richard Williams? Did he knock on the door? Say, where's Richard playing
tennis?
Tennis.
It was. Yeah.
What was it? You had a visit from Prince Michael?
No, not quite. No. So I ended up. We did an event. It was called the Concours of Elegance, which takes place at Hampton Court Palace every year, and Prince Michael of Kent is the patron, so he's kind of a guest visitor every year, and he was there this year. And
you see what you've inspired our undergraduates to, Richard Fitzwilliams, with your constant drive on the monarchs and the royals, etc. They're now actually sort of engaging events where we've got members of the royal family in attendance.
He's back here at uni eating spaghetti and beans. I mean, what a fall from grace.
I'm glad I can take some credit for it. One of the things in Vienna, though, is you absolutely cannot escape, though it's been a republic since 1918 when the Emperor Karl abdicated. The Franz Josef had died in 1916 after a reign of 68 years, and you simply can't escape monarchy.
You were going to say Mozart. I was sure you were going to say you can't escape Mozart. Beethoven.
And Breuger. Well, I mean, regarding Mozart, I went to a concert in the Karlskirche, which...
that must have been amazing.
That was lovely. I have to say the church, I mean, to me, if you don't like Baroque, it's wise to stay away from some Viennese churches because they really, I mean, the numbers of decorations, the scale of it all.
European churches, though, it's very Baroque, isn't it? Hmm. It's one of the wonderful things about going around Europe.
I mean, Austria specializes in Baroque. But what fascinated me, I mean, you go into the Art History Museum, and I was lucky enough to do that before they closed the Bruegel's, because they're having a major exhibition celebrating his work, and you see the Tower of Babel, which inspired John Huston when he made the Bible, the recreation in the film, although it was far too short. Absolutely extraordinary, and Hunters in the Snow, for example, and whether it's Holbein's portrait of Jane Seymour, or whether it's Vermeer, portrait of the artist. I mean, it's absolutely gorgeous collection. I mean, what is so extraordinary is the scale of these. The museums are a little heavy, claustrophobic sometimes, because unlike the Leopold, which is relatively modern, it really would be a gigantic work to refurbish them. I mean, a lot of them, the natural history, say, is very old.
But what is it, Richard, about Vienna? So you've got all this amazing art, you've got Mozart, you've got Beethoven, you've got Freud. How come Vienna has been
centralist Europe?
Do you think that's what it was?
Geographical histories that actually have brought
these folks together. The historical side of it, I mean, the Viennese realize, I mean, Franz Josef was never blamed for the First World War, although he undoubtedly...
Yeah, typical Viennese, you see. It's not me.
Slopey shoulders.
Exactly. I mean, they still claim that little small chap who wanted to be painted and decorated decided to invade Poland. He wasn't Austrian either. If he was, you know, you just can't just step away from that.
One has to say the scale of it was quite interesting. Sarkers, which plays such a part, you remember The Third Man, which is such an iconic British film directed by Carol Reed with Trevor Howard.
And Orson Welles.
And Orson Welles, who waited until the very last part of the film. They had to film him, of course, because he was so pivotal, for obvious reasons. You think he was going to go down a sewer? They had to recreate the sewers in England, and his fee went up. He was tough to deal with, but he was magic as one of the cinema's most immortal villains. I mean, the scene on the Prater, the Viennese, the Great Wheel, is iconic cinema. Wells pretended or encouraged the legend that he wrote the bit about the cuckoo clock There's a famous scene for Leonis, of course, we'll know it tremendously, probably by heart.
He's not with us, so let's just move on. And if you're worried about what's talking about the third man, well, for goodness sakes, use the internet, find out about it. It's well worth seeing. Ellie, I'm going to award you the role of choosing which movie to ask Richard to review first.
I'm going to ask you about American Animals. This may be a mistake, because I don't actually know what it's like.
It's extraordinary. It's
so
thrilling.
I'm hoping it's a cartoon. I'm hoping
not
it's
quite.
No.
Is it not?
Not quite.
Not quite.
Tell us about American Animals then, Richard.
Well, American Animals is a heist movie, and we'll have to go to ask for leaders, and will, in fact, when I connect with him next, he's directed by Bart Layden. It has a very, very ingenious way of telling the story of one of the most sensational heists attempted in America in 2003 in Transylvania University in Kentucky. And our sympathies are, of course, with those who were attempting to steal some rare books from the college library to flog them for what they believe are going to be millions. It's quite amazing. This is an extraordinary movie. And the question I was going to ask is about the morality of it, because it does involve violence, no spoilers for me, but nonetheless, your sympathies are so totally with those who are perpetrating this heist.
I can tell you now, Richard, mine aren't. I'm responsible for a university. I don't agree with encouraging these students.
Well said, Ellie. Well said indeed.
Do you know, taking books out the library... Exactly. It impacts on everyone. You've got to think about what you're doing to other students when you do that.
I mean, such morality here. I mean, this is what I will bring up with Phil, because it links with the famous occasion of Bonnie and Clyde in the 1960s, when, I mean, if you think back, a criticism of, obviously Roger Ebert as the famous film critic of recent years. Pauline Kael was famous, of course, for that as a New Yorker film critic, but also less well-known was Boslick Crowther, was the New Yorker film, New York Times film critic, and he had an obsessive horror of the theme of Bonnie and Clyde, which he saw as glamorizing violence. And he wrote
which
not one...
Which does happen an awful lot nowadays, especially. I mean, you can't go to the cinema without violence being glamorized. You know,
it's
Tarantino
true.
Level, really, didn't he?
Well, I mean, Bonnie and Clyde, of course, Crowther's obsession was to write not one, not two, but three reviews attacking the film. And by the time it was being reassessed, he was trying to even interfere with the letter pages of the New York Times to put in more attacks on it, and it cost him his job because the cinema had moved on. And there's no question with a movie like American Animals, you do root, and so to speak, for those who perpetrate this outrageous crime. I mean, we meet Spencer, played by Barry Keoghan, who wants some excitement. There's Warren, played by Evan Peters, who's on an athletic scholarship and is very bored. And the two decide to steal a valuable edition of Audubon's The Birds of America, which is supposedly worth a fortune.
And maybe, Richard, we should leave them in detention. Maybe that's all they will ever deserve.
I think, Ellie, you just nailed it one after the other today.
I'm just on fire. And I think we should look at The Little Stranger.
We've got the fake elderly disguises to actually talk about.
Yeah, exactly. I know. You can't cut the review so early. I can see a certain fear that this might be emulated in Lincoln.
It's fresh as week. We're into,
don't give anyone any ideas.
Exactly.
We're in the middle of trying to...
Warren goes to Amsterdam to negotiate a price from dealers before they have the books, and he believes they can make millions. Now, their surprise is, I'm being very careful of spoilers here, but they have to hire two more, Eric, played by Jared Abramson, for logistics, and Chaz, played by the wealthy Blake Jenner, as a getaway driver. The only problem is that there is one guardian of these books, a librarian, Jean Gooch, played by Anne Dowd. And the day of the robbery, they actually enter disguised as businessmen, but the librarian has a meeting. What do they do? What subsequently happens? And parts of this film are very, very funny. What distinguishes it from other heist movies is the fact that you've not only got, obviously, the actors playing these characters, but what puts you so particularly, who won't approve of this, on the side of those perpetrating this heist is the fact that it's only 2003, so it's only 15 years ago, and those who were young then are still pretty young, and they also comment live on in the film, as do their parents, though fleetingly. So what it is a very interesting device where you've got the actors playing these characters. You've also got them talking now about what it was like and what they did. You've got a certain amount of regret, which quite honestly is tagged on at the end of the movie, and I don't think most people will remember. And you've got a movie also that's pacey, it's very exciting, and it's a musical score, I do have to comment on it, it's extremely appealing, and visually it's rather striking. So you really want to know what happens and what happens afterwards. So I'm not, of course, going to give any clues, but it's a very unusual way of making a movie. It works extremely well. You will all be pleased about this. It's hardly made any money at all, which I find very surprising.
Well, let's just hold it momentarily there. Ben, you, I believe, were 7 when this heist took place, so you might remember 2004. You were 7 or you would have been in junior school?
Roughly, I was about 7, yeah, you're right.
About me, exactly.
Older than that, actually. Slightly.
See, you could have been lifting library books from your primary school.
I was about eight years old.
Is it a movie you will be going to see?
I think I would, yeah. I mean, it wouldn't be at the top of my list, but it does sound like quite an interesting film. The cast seems pretty good as well. I recognise a couple of the cast, so it's,
okay.
You know, it's something I think I would be interested in, yeah.
Comedy, drama, mystery and suspense, although based on a real-life story, sounds as preposterous as actually having a president of the United States who used to actually host his own reality TV programme. That's never going to happen.
Oh, incidentally, Ben, how would you like one day to become a librarian and you might be the only person guarding books that might be sold?
I don't
There's
know.
There's a career path you
I don't know.
Considered.
If it all goes wrong for me, Richard, that's where I think I'll end up.
Ellie, I suspect not on your list of things to do.
Well, do you know what? I'm going to upset everyone. I just think, what is wrong with movies today? I've been watching the Raiders of the Lost Ark and all of that, the lovely third one, which is everyone's favourite, which is...
That's the one with Sean Connery, of course. Kingdom of the Crystal Cave. It's Last Crusade.
The Last Crusade. And these are just amazing films and Jurassic Park.
You had Ready
Park
Player One this year. That was quite good. You had Ant-Man and the Wasp. That was very good.
Star Wars. What we've had from Quantum of Solace to Ant-Man and the Wasp, you're really plumbing the depths.
We're digging the depths, aren't we? Good, decent movies. I want films to come back to be as
like
good
the third
as they
man.
Once were.
Oh, well, The Third Man was classic. It's probably in my top 10 of movies of all time. I mean, it's a really...
What's your number one, though, Richard?
Lawrence of Arabia.
That is Lawrence of Arabia. But it is extraordinary with Indiana.
Doesn't he just
that...
annoy you a little bit? Because he's always moaning.
Who, Lawrence?
Yeah, Lawrence. He's just moaning through the movie.
Whinge.
Very British.
That was a very appropriate... description of the various moods, a disturbed but fascinating character. I mean, Peter O'Toole plays him so amazingly. Did I feel that? I was absolutely fascinated by the way it's perhaps one of the most unusual heroes in cinema history. And I thought it was the most extraordinary performance by O'Toole, because you had someone who was a flamboyant masochist, you had somebody who was extremely courageous, you had someone who also had an idea of the duplicitous politics
Richard, at 25 minutes to 9 o'clock, or 24 minutes to 9 o'clock on a Thursday morning, I never thought we'd have the phrase flamboyant masochists being aired on Siren Radio. It's almost like talking about a gothic horror film based on the novel by Sarah Waters, of course, The Little Stranger.
Directed by Lenny Abrams, who made Room, which was absolutely brilliant and did so well at the Oscars. Now, this could be certainly a sort of gothic drama, I would call it. Dr. Faraday, set in the 1940s, or most of it is, there are flashbacks. Dr. Faraday, played by Donald Gleason, is a country psychiatrist and is called to the 18th century estate Hundreds Hall. And he's haunted by the memory that when a boy, he and the house was then being used was then in fact in its prime, and the family living there was. He and his mother had been admitted to the house, and he'd broken an ornamental acorn off, and his mother was outraged. Here we see it in very different times. The family has serious problems, both financial and psychological. And could there be another reason for the horrors that may well or this house? What, in fact, is actually happening? Strange sounds. Very effective, the photography, I thought. And also, again, music. When you take houses, and I'm thinking of certain films where houses have played a very, very significant part. It's almost as though they're a character in the film. And I think of Road to Perdition or Visconti's The Damned. There are reasons for finding this film particularly scary. It isn't an ordinary horror film. On the other hand, it's a form of a thriller horror, I thought. The house now belongs to Roderick Ayres, played by Jack Poulter, who's a disfigured RAF veteran and an alcoholic, and Mrs. Ayres, Charlotte Rampling, his mother, and her daughter Caroline, her sister, played by Ruth Wilson, also lived there. This is the family in decline. It's got no money. It doesn't socialize much. It's in dire straits. But what is it that draws Dr. Faraday back to a place that's haunted him ever since that childhood incident? And what is happening in this house? There's a house party where a child is savaged by Caroline's Labrador. Roderick drinks too much and is severely disfigured. Dr. Faraday tries to help him, but he sets a library on fire, which is rather strange. Also, the servants' bells seem to be ringing, and no one seems to be pulling them. Writing by possibly someone who is deceased, or...
He's trying very hard not to give spoilers away. Read the book, it's a lot better.
I have to say that the movie I found very intriguing, but what it is symbolic of is the way that the corrosive class system, this is the symbolic way Dr. Faraday, for example, is completely he's drawn into it, he's attracted but to the family and also to Caroline. What happens the relationship with her, and what happens to Mrs. Ayres when she starts discovering a great deal of what's really going on in the house, and could there be someone else there?
And the very name Dr. Faraday might give something away with respect to electrical charges and such like, but I won't get
that. Well, I have to say, I have to say, I was intrigued by it, and I'm not fond of horror films, but this one certainly...
It's a cage. It's a gothic cage written by Sarah Waters, and after Figuresmith and various other things, she knows what she's about, does Sarah?
And I'm not sure that the backers of the film would believe that it knew necessarily what audience it was aiming at, because it's done very badly at the box office, unfortunately, but it has only just opened, and I have to say I had a lot to enjoy, and also the flashbacks to the early scenes when he's young and...
Not necessarily a widescreen movie, more a movie you'd like to watch on your 7-inch tablet, I feel, really.
I would never encourage anyone to watch a movie on a 7-inch tablet, simply because if you've got the chance of the widescreen experience, always take it, as you know. That's heresy. I mean, that, in fact, is heresy perpetrated by... Darren Aronofsky actually said, he was in a ferocious argument with Quentin Tarantino.
Yes, but it wasn't Jello wrestling. That's the whole thing. It should have been Aronofsky versus Tarantino in a mud bath.
What, Aaron? Good heavens, and more fantasies going on. What happens with Aronofsky was he actually said that he thought it was perfectly reasonable that people should watch his films on their mobile phones if they so wished. And Tarantino, as you know, is very keen on the widest screen possible.
How else can you see all the blood and gore being developed? You know,
there's always that argument, but the point is, how else can you really get involved in the atmosphere of a film? And this is one thing that The Little Stranger does have. It is atmospheric. And, of course, the music and the visuals.
It's nice
and
to
how
see...
We've seen horror films, of course, from The Others, that too had... Remember, the house played a very, very significant part in it. I mean, there's no doubt that it is, so to speak, almost a character in this film. I think symbolically that it's its message about class. Whether that will resonate with audiences in Britain, it'll be quite interesting to see. Whether
it may be resuscitated in years to come. Who knows? It could be a cult classic.
Ruth Wilson was one of the best Jane Eyres I ever saw on a television series, and I thought she was extremely good. Donald Gleeson's First Class, and I mean, Charlotte Rampling's always rather. It's got tremendous presence.
It's being married to Jean-Michel Jarre for all those years. Ben, will you be going to see The Wonderful Joys of The Little Stranger?
Well, this is a good background noise, isn't it?
It is, but, actually, yes.
No, I personally didn't think I would. I mean, the horror films aren't, for me, really, they're not something I particularly enjoy, because I can't take them too seriously. Mm. But Alex, honestly, this is... No, for me, horror films aren't something I really enjoy much just now, because I don't often see good horror films. Mm. I think personally I probably wouldn't see this one.
How would you define a good horror film?
Oh, well, it needs to be realistic. It needs to be, I think, done well. And actually acted out well.
Serial killers, monsters.
What about Hereditary? Did you see that?
No, I didn't.
Are you a zombie man, though?
I'm not a zombie man, no. I don't really do any... It's got to be realistic. I mean, Serial Killers, I think, it's pretty realistic. It's close to it. Yeah. But
Brad Pitt knows what to do with zombies.
Quite World War Z.
Yeah. I'm still impressed. Thank you very much. I'm still impressed.
Is that Alex? Does he keep doing that? Exactly. Has he got his own theme tune now? Why don't I have a theme tune?
I'm very puzzled by the music that...
It's Alex. He's not feeling well.
We just have to keep bravely go through the whole thing. Ellie, will you be checking out The Little Stranger?
No, like Ben, as you can probably tell, I'm not a horror film person. I like happy films. Oh. I like jolly films.
Ballerina,
I
that's
don't
very good.
Think anyone yeah. could make a case for The Little Stranger as a happy film.
No, it's not for me. The bit about the Labrador, I mean, that's I'm a Labrador lover.
Exactly.
You know,
makes two of us.
It was the deal breaker.
I'm not.
You wouldn't
yeah,
want
was,
to be yeah. attacked by this Labrador, believe me.
I know, and how can you do that? Labrador reputations everywhere. So
Ben,
yeah, not for me. Big thumbs down.
Ben, would you like to throw those last two questions to the table tennis playing Richard Fitzwilliams?
Yes, table tennis playing Richard Fitzwilliams. Have you enjoyed your tenor-flight nymphs today this morning?
Oh, and honestly, yes, and I'm glad, you know, when you're next down in Soho and spying, who knows what you'll see.
Well, I'll come and approach you for a game.
Given the connections that we actually had with the joys of the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra last night, and of course Luke Carradine, composer extraordinaire from Cannes, which, Ellie, you'd be pleased to know, Heather Knox was duly impressed with and indeed stayed for the whole show last night.
I know. I was still in the office when she came back at 8 o'clock.
Well.
So you kept her out very late last night.
It was the first time she'd ever done the full show, but yes.
She loved it. She really loved it.
There we are, you see. So good news from that front. Sorry, Ben.
That's all right. Richard, will you be joining us again next week?
I certainly hope so, and hopefully Phil will be as well.
And Ellie, Billy Joel or Ultravox?
Ultravox, please.
Ultravox.
Oh, hang on. Which Billy Joel?
Well, the title of both is the same, and it ties in with what
Vienna.
Richard... Exactly.
Oh, so, I'm going to go for Ultravox, please.
Quite rightly so.
Good choice. We'll be right back.
music is weaving. Hunting nuts, pizzicato strings, the rhythm is calling. Alone in the night as the daylight brings a cool empty silence. Sky, it fades to the distance.
Still to come on the programme today, Dr. Sarah Jarvis will be talking about Stoptober. Yes, it's time to add to the big quit with 400,000 smokers quitting successfully last year in England. Okay. If you're thinking, don't start at all, just do not do this in any way, shape, or stay away from that. We'll also be talking about the joys of the University of Lincoln with the Chancellor of the University. That would be Lord Victor Adebowale, a CBE, who should be with us as well in the next part of the programme. Also, Jack Messenger. I'll be talking about his recent novel, Farewell Olympus, and McFly, is it Busted or McFly? I think, well, either of those two, and of course they have been McBusted. We'll have Izzy Judd, who's the celebrity mom and blogger and indeed wife of, I believe, Harry Judd, who is
the drummer.
Exactly.
The drummer.
So there we are, Izzy Judd is joining us, all of which paves the way for another mini little classic with the awesome Ian Lennox. How are you, Ian?
I'm very well, thank you.
Historic times, but Ian, because our man from Brighton, currently a few points ahead of Newcastle United in the league table, but then again, they've got more points.
Alex, I wouldn't talk about football after last night, I really wouldn't.
Look, these things happen every so often. And
they certainly did.
Yes, yeah, step away for the benefit.
If I was you, I'd demand a recount. Everyone else seems to do it even though they get disappointed.
Well, look, when all's said and done, Mikel Arteta had to look after the Leds as opposed to Pep Guardiola, who was obviously banished for the whole thing after the Liverpool debacle last year, and all sorts of other challenges. Sorry, Ellie, we're talking about the European Champions League here.
I have no idea.
So there we are. Neither did many of the City players, but that's okay. We'll just have to move away from that. Anyway, Ben is back. That's the important thing, Ian. You said after a year, you've never seen Ben, but he's back.
Morning, Ian.
Who is Benny?
Who is Ben, did you say? Who is Ben? Did you say who is Ben there?
Brighton.
Yep. Ben from Brighton. Brighton Ben.
Oh, sorry, mate. Oh, right. Sorry, I thought it was another footballer.
I've gone well past that.
Yeah.
Some of the others look well past it as well.
Well, I mean, Ellie, I was going to introduce you as the awesome Ellie Sample creator of course, the Lincolnshire puppy. Again, Ian might decide.
Ian will say who. Exactly. He's got very forgetful.
And he noticed.
Yeah.
Oh, Ian.
But, you know, it comes to us all.
Yeah.
Okay. Time flies by. And
oh, well. Life continues. So how are you, Mr. Lennox?
Yeah, have you written your book yet, Ian?
I'm going to start today. Well, tomorrow, or the day after. I've got the first scene in my head.
Excellent.
And I've got a rough idea about the setting and the time and the place.
Mm-hmm.
Not much else, though. But I'll just put the boat out and see where I go.
That sounds brilliant.
Surely, Ian, it should be put the boot out. Put the boot out.
Boot out?
Put the boat out. You shall have a fishy on a little dishy when the boat comes in.
Are you going to remember to save it now each time you make an entry, Ian?
These are crucial points.
Ben has not forgotten
the crisis, which I think was about 2 or 3 years ago, coming up to the anniversary.
You're in the process of your other book.
Ian was all sorted, the book was all there, and suddenly, work not saved, disaster debacle. Very frustrating.
What happened?
Yeah, you see. Bless him.
Have we got the right Ian? Is this Ian Lennox?
Ian, I believe back with one of your books, you had a problem saving it, or it didn't save on your computer, or you thought you'd lost all the work.
200 words, wasn't it? I think you lost.
Yes, I do remember that now. Yeah,
yeah, you see, this is what it comes of. Just it's,
you know, it, one of my friends was an academic. He wrote, he started to write a book about Stendhal, and he was averaging about a chapter a month. And he came into the pub one night, ashen face, and he wiped the whole chapter. He never got started again. He was so sickened by it.
Well, Stendhal, in similar times, would have written Scarlet and Black and would have actually sort of still kept going because, of course, he used a quill pen, I believe. But there we are. That's a different line.
Well, yeah, but somebody could have put some... Who's the guy who wrote some worthy tome and the servant put it on the fire by mistake?
Yeah, it happens.
Wasn't that in Blackadder? That was Prince Charles. That was Blackadder plot. That was when they wrote the dictionary, wasn't it?
Was it Johnson? No.
Yeah, it was Mr. Johnson, and it was Baldrick put it on the fire.
Oh no, that's no. This is real life.
And Blackadder isn't a documentary. You're listening to Random Thoughts on Siren Radio. My edition. On the 20th of September.
Exactly. I think our listener might.
I think we should all use a microphone for 30 seconds to Google this.
There's a demand for this.
It's a way forward. Well, I feel it's the yin to Richard Fitzwilliam's yang in many ways. You got Richard and his worthy tomes about Austria and movies, and then of course the more side of more esoteric side of our resident Geordie, which I think every university needs a resident Geordie. I think I should go on record when you're next in touch with the Minister of Higher Education. Why not a resident Geordie for every university?
Well, we could move to Tyneside.
Whoa.
I think they have a university.
Now, do you want to run that past Chancellor of the University and perhaps Professor Mary Stuart's Vice Chancellor and say, thoughts of the university, let's move to Tyneside. Well. Strangely enough, that's what happened when we were in Humberside. Whoa!
I once had a very famous actress stay with me on my lodgings, and she was at the RSC, and she said, oh, I'd love to live here. And I said, I've got a slight problem. You work in Stratford.
She could commute. I mean, yeah, that's a little Stratford. Yeah. I mean, that's honestly the only
problem. Your idea was to bring the theatre up to Newcastle, I think.
A plot twist, Shakespeare was also from Newcastle. He just commuted to Stratford every day.
Together with his wife, who was busy writing plays. That's
William Howard, the lad Shakespeare.
I mean, and strangely enough, I'm sure that that's the bit that Anne Hathaway probably didn't sort of want to have in it.
Everyone was wondering why I came from.
Put the boot in over that one, yeah.
To be or Howard the lads, not
why
to be.
Why are you?
Exactly. Why are you to be or not to be?
We are sort of missing the point, though, that Lincoln is one of the best places in the entire world to live. It's one of the most beautiful places. Uh-huh. It's got everything going for it. 1 in 5 people in Lincoln is a student, which makes it another good reason. Uh-huh. It's the friendliest city in the UK, according to the Big Lunch. And it's also got one of the steepest streets in the UK.
I know.
And it was voted Britain's best street as well in 2012, was it? 2012?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And also, the castle was built by William the Conqueror, which not a lot of people know. Yeah. And the cathedral used to be the tallest in the UK.
No, the tallest in the world? world for 249 years. Yeah. I shouldn't know this, but I do.
So what happened?
Basically, the spire fell down.
Yeah. Well, it was lightning, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was it.
It was lightning.
Yeah, it didn't just. It wasn't poor workmanship. It wasn't shoddy routine. It wasn't that.
Not
wasn't
in
it,
Lincoln. Like, no, yeah, exactly. Quality work. Exactly. Not
who forgot the cement?
It was taller than the pyramids in Egypt, which was the structure that was the tallest.
I mean, Alfreda Saint Pet had to employ Tyneside workers as opposed to workers from the East Midlands. Although I think
we were all busy.
Exactly.
We were working hard. No, Lincoln's a fantastic place. So if you haven't been here, everyone do come.
So there we are, Ian. Those are just some of the reasons by our director of communications at the University of Lincoln, Ellie Sample, as to why you should be in Lincoln, and of course Ben. From Brighton, who you'd forgotten all about, but anyway, he's back.
And we really like Ian as well. And I think he needs someone to look after him, given that his memory is not quite what it was. So I think he perhaps ought to.
How did he pick
coming.
Up the name Ben from Brighton? Who got that from Brighton?
I think you need a resident Lincolner there, don't you? In Tyneside, we're doing an exchange program.
Exactly. It's the post Brexit routine. You'll be referred to as Ian from Newcastle. It's a way forward. Ian, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the program today?
Yes, it's been very amusing.
Are you back with us again next week?
I do hope so.
Excellent. We'll see you then.
Especially if Man City lose again.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. Just let it go. Let it go, Ian. Cause I want you, and I need you, and I'm down for you always. And I'm down for you always. And I'm down for you, down for you, down for you always. Siren Radio. Excellent. And the weather today, highs of 18 degrees centigrade, lows of 11 degrees centigrade, and it'll be a day of heavy rain and breezes. Well, what better way to actually keep a healthy mind, healthy body, than to actually start talking about the upcoming Stoptober with the awesomely talented Dr. Sarah Jarvis, GP extraordinaire. How are you, Sarah?
Oh, thank you. I'm feeling very fine indeed after that.
Brilliant. 400,000 smokers quit successfully last year, which is great news. 1,000 smokers quit each day on average, one every 80 seconds. So we are getting to the stage where hopefully I think the last cigarette will be smoked in the very near future.
Well, we are, but we're not there yet. There's no room for complacency. We have come a very long way. It's extraordinary to think that in 1974, long before either of us were born, obviously, Alex, 45% of adults in England smoked. We, 10 years ago, in your part of the country, in the East Midlands, were down to 20%. We are now down to 15.7%, so you're slightly above the national average, but really working on it. And the aim is, as things are going, to get to 10% by 2023.
Which is awesome stuff. Let's turn to the studio. Ben Lewis, I suspect you've never smoked.
No.
Which is good news, and you're not going to start, are you?
No, I'm not.
Ellie, have you ever been tempted to partake ever back in the day?
I smoked for a long time. I only recently gave up, and that's been really tough, to be honest. Right.
Sarah is your go-to person with respect to that. I mean, a good hurrah there for you, Sarah, so that's marvellous. Was it a conscious decision earlier that you said yes, or were you influenced by Stoptober and events such as that?
No, I was probably one of the hardcore, I'm no quitter kind of guys, but I finally reached the stage where I was coughing constantly and I realised that I had no choice other than to stop smoking. And I always remember I interviewed Jules Holland when I was probably Ben's age, when I was a wee student, and he said to me that giving up smoking was harder than giving up heroin. And I think that was based on other people's experiences, not his own, in terms of what he'd observed before I caused any issues. But yeah, that always stuck with me. And I think giving up smoking is definitely the hardest thing to do. I gave it up for a year, 2 years ago, and then went back and ended up smoking even more. And then has given up again. And my heart goes out to anyone attempting to do that.
Well, this time, the good news, and you had a really good incentive, 83% of smokers who want to quit have at least one health reason for doing so. The thing that really surprised me, which the same figure suggests, only one in three smokers say that it's saving money. Now, when you consider that it costs you over £3,000 a year if you smoke 20 a day, I have to say, I just had no idea. When I was coming into this campaign, I had to go into a shop and check how much cigarettes were, and I was looking at, what?
To be honest, though, Sarah, it makes no difference. There's a kind of magic. It's very weird.
Okay.
No matter what's going on, you always have enough money for a pack of cigarettes.
Yeah.
And since I've given up smoking, I have less money rather than more money. I have no idea why that is, but I can honestly tell you, hand on heart, there is no financial incentive.
No, Dan, that is because you have a life, honestly. Now, can I ask you, did you go cold turkey?
No, I went onto an electronic cigarette, and I did that for a while until I realised that that was making me feel just as bad as a normal cigarette.
Okay.
And so I gave up altogether, and then I went cold turkey.
Two issues there. Actually, you were trying to do it with one arm tied behind your back by just using a smoking cessation aid. Whether it's a smoking cessation aid like e-cigarettes, or whether it's other kinds like gum, patches, etc., or medication, then doing it with a combination of that and support, what we know is that by using both, you've got a 51% quit rate, whereas with e-cigarettes, actually, and support, there's a 63% quit rate, whereas doing it cold turkey, more than 9 in 10 people fail. And that's why the free personal quit plan, which is there with Stoptober this year, you go online, they ask you three simple questions. How soon after you wake up do you have a cigarette? How many cigarettes a day do you smoke? And have you tried to quit before? And then once you've done that, it helps you to tailor what you need. So there's a Stoptober app. You can get daily emails. You can get Facebook Messenger. And then you can put in your postcode and find local services which will provide face-to-face support and details about smoking cessation aids. And what's interesting this year is that actually Public Health England have recognised for some time, but are beginning to go out there and say, do you know what? Some people tried one smoking cessation aid. They might have tried gum and it didn't work for them. But actually, if you combine smoking cessation services with two aids, so maybe one patch which helps you kind of through the day, and then something to maybe it's an e-cigarette that helps you get through those really, really difficult moments, you may do even better. And they're actively saying that even that combination, so much safer. Lots of concerns about e-cigarettes out there, but actually the Royal College of GPs, the British Medical Association, Cancer Research UK all say e-cigarettes are safer. And Public Health England has looked at the evidence with the Royal College of Physicians, and they both say it's about 95% safer than cigarettes.
I do think that is absolutely exceptional advice, because one of the things that really put me off early on was the fact that e-cigarettes and the cessation packages you could get were so expensive.
Mm.
So it was a real off-putter to actually even try them.
And yet you were spending £10 a day on cigarettes.
I know, but they made me happy.
But Siren Radio makes you happy as well, Ellie, in the Midweek Drive
we'll
Morning Edition.
Back. Don't misunderstand. I'm so
and
glad.
Siren Radio
I've
is
given
priceless.
It. I'm so glad.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah.
I do feel I should share, and this is maybe a bit too personal, might be a bit depressing for first thing in the morning, but funny enough, my mum's always smoked, and last night she rang me, and she'd been to the cancer clinic yesterday, and she was diagnosed yesterday with cancer. And so I think you coming on today is absolutely fantastic, because I can't tell you how real that is.
Of course.
So,
of course.
Yeah.
And there are going to be, sadly, there are going to be hundreds of thousands of people out there whose lives have been touched by the health effects of smoking. I mean, just in terms of cost, but the £2.5 billion it costs a year to the NHS gives you an idea of how many people have been affected by the health effects of smoking.
Although I have to say that the health service is possibly funded by all that tax.
Yes,
that
okay.
You mentioned.
Oh,
no, don't go there. Don't go there, Ellie, please.
I'm just saying what every smoker's thinking.
Sarah, it's been awesome. Where can people
really
go to
awesome.
To find out further information about Stoptober and some of the advice that we've shared today?
Go on to your internet search, put in Stoptober, look out for the free personal quit plan, go for it.
And the usual two questions for your good self, Sarah. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us yourself this morning?
I have had a ravishing telephonic link. And I'm so sorry, Ellie. But I have to say, I think it was a really, really brave thing you just did.
Absolutely. And that's the sort of message that Jeremy Vine would kill for, personally. But still, Sarah, will you be kind enough to join us again in the very near future?
It would be my absolute pleasure.
A round of applause, please, for the awesome Dr. Sarah Jarvis. Yay!
I kept on seeing him look at me while he's with that other girl. Do you think he was just doing that to make me jealous? Because he was totally texting me all night last night, and I don't know if it's a booty call or not. So, like, what do you think? Did you think that girl was pretty? How did that girl even get in here? Do you see her? She's so short, and that dress is so tacky. Who wears Cheetah? It's not even summer. Why does the DJ keep on playing Summertime Sadness? After we get out of the bathroom, can we go smoke a cigarette? I really need one. But first, let me take a selfie.
So from Chainsmokers to hashtag selfie to technology, 7 in 10 British folk have admitted to feeling that they're losing control of their own lives, with over a quarter describing themselves as disorganised when at home. With additional research linking general happiness and well-being to the amount of control we feel at home, is there some way in which technology could actually be the answer to put our domestic affairs in order? Well, who better than Oxford University scholar Professor Anna Marmadaro to talk about this and the way in which technology can lead the way to a stress-free home life. Can't technology add to stresses, Anna?
Hello, Alex.
Yes.
Hi.
So in terms of the technology, this particular research that suggests that 70% of British folk feel they're losing control of their own lives. Were you surprised by this particular aspect?
Yes, quite interesting to us to have this data that has been provided by Siemens. The research program tells us that about 70% of British people feel loss of control in their life. 26% of them feel that they are disorganized. And there is, of course, a link there. Lack of organization leads to feeling not being on top of what we are doing or what to do. And in the home life, this situation plays out in figures such as 65% of us would feel embarrassed if a guest popped around unexpectedly. 54% of us would just bury our heads in the sand when we have to face domestic chores. One-fifth of us would not even know what they're going to prepare for dinner. This, of course, leads to a feeling of being unsettled, lack of control, being disempowered in doing what we would like to do at home to have a serene, happy, stable life. Now, 27% of us identifies lack of help at home as one of the main reasons why things are such. Good news, 37% of us also believe that technology can help here by helping us regaining control of our life. And this is precisely the line of thinking that drives Siemens in their thinking about new appliances that can enable people to regain control in our life by providing prompts, for example, or by facilitating the carrying out of domestic chores. Now, this aligns very well with the research that Professor Robin Murphy and myself have been carrying out at Oxford on the topic of people's well-being. So our own research shows that people that feel organized, feel in control of their lives, feel empowered, efficient, successful, they feel they can make a difference, they feel causal agents in the world. And this supports their well-being, makes them feel nimble, feel free to devote their time to a multiplicity of things. And that works very well in the complexity of our modern lives. So the thought here is that developing technology that can support getting us more organized at home will just empower us to do better what we need to do at home and do more of what we want to do outside the home by having more free time and just a nimbler mind.
This is absolutely fascinating stuff, Anna. And I mean, clearly, as the official fellow in philosophy from the University of Oxford, I mean, there's a whole range there in terms of technology. Ben, any thoughts with respect to this particular experience?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say, personally, I think I like to think of myself as an organised person. I think it's something, whether technology would help me in that respect, I think it does to a certain extent with perhaps my phone. But I think maybe, would you say traditional routines also perhaps may also help in that, with that respect, for some people who don't like to rely on technology?
Or indeed worry about Wi-Fi granting access to Home Connect, flexibility and all those sort of things, which might seem okay, but might, as I said at the start, Anna, could even cause more stress. I mean, I'm just taking the opposing philosophical view here.
Yes, indeed, I can see the other point of view. On the other hand, there are studies that are showing that when we just stuff our minds with lots of thoughts of things that we need to do, our mind becomes less efficient. That's quite analogous to what would happen to a machine with many physical tasks to perform. It just energy disperses in all these things that need to be done. So the thought here is that technology would support us by allowing us to concentrate on some key things we want to do, things that would promote our well-being without our attention being dispersed. Lots of tasks that are not so important in our life. If I were to choose whether to devote my time doing the shopping, checking what I need to buy, by looking at the fridge, programming my washing machine, and spending time with friends and colleagues and children, and my children, I would go for the latter for sure.
Anna, I think you've raised a whole range of issues here, very major talking points. Where can people go to find out further information about the Siemens survey and the kind of things we've been talking about today?
Well, for Siemens Home UK, that's a place to go. And for our own research is Professor Murphy's website at the University of Oxford.
It's been awesome sharing some thoughts with you. Still, I've got two final things to ask you, Anna. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today? Has it been okay for you? And I'm using okay in the kind of philosophical, gender-based sense of saying, is it reasonable? Has it been acceptable?
Yes, that's good. Thank you.
Good. So hopefully we can connect with you again in the not-too-distant future. Professor Anna Marmadaro, official fellow in philosophy from the University of Oxford. Many thanks indeed, and we'll speak again very soon.
Thank you.
Rightly so too, especially when you talk about new research into the early years of parenthood, discovering the worries that people feel on a daily basis, with over 3/4 of parents admitting that it's an incredibly anxious time for them. Indeed, parents feeling anxious up to 12 times a day. And to talk about this particular study and more, who better than celebrity mum and well-known blogger extraordinaire, the amazingly talented Izzy Judd. How are you, Izzy?
Hi, Alex. I'm good. I'm enjoying listening to that. excellent.
I'm pleased you said that. I'm pleased you said that. The Heart Never Lies, McFly, great band. Yeah, exactly. The message is there. Now, there isn't a how-to manual for being a parent, but lots of scholars over the years have attempted to produce all sorts of things, etc. Just share with us your own thoughts, because you're a new mum yourself, of course.
Yeah, so I have Lola, who is nearly three, and Kit, who's one. And I don't think anything prepares you for parenthood. I think Harry and I kind of went into it, obviously all excited and just delighted to, you know, be starting our family. And then this little human being arrives and you think, what, you're going to let us take this home? What, you know, what do we do now?
Is there not a kit?
Exactly. What do we do? So I think, yeah, I was amazed by this kind of research that's come out with Aveeno Baby this week about the anxiety that parents feel and how often and how common it is. Because I think as a new mum, you do often feel quite alone with your anxiety. So it's reassuring and comforting to know that we're all going through it, really.
Child constantly crying, a rash developing on the child, are the most alarming situations for parents. No matter how many times people turn around and say, oh, it's all right, it's perfectly natural, I suppose there's always that line of, oh, well, they're really saying this. What if it isn't? What if they've actually been taken over by aliens from a different planet?
I know, and I think for me, certainly, both my two have very sensitive skin. Obviously, it's actually National Eczema Week this week. And I think for me, the worry that I've had about my children's health has been something that has been something that's taken me by surprise. I think, you know, obviously when you're not just worrying about yourself anymore, you're worrying about your child, and it's something that you know little about. And I think, you know, it's funny because we're kind of growing up in that world where social media is very much there. And I think one of the positive sides of social media is the support that mums can give to each other. And that's often what I've found when I've had, you know, experiencing something with my babies, and then to go and share with other mums and ask them what advice they've got, I think has been really helpful. And I've certainly experienced that with my children's eczema and obviously what products to use. So I think, yeah, I think we're all, it's just nice to feel that we kind of got each other to support each other, which I think is a really positive side of social media.
I know our northeastern correspondent Ian Lennox would be quite astounded to find that it's children from the northeast most likely to have eczema, compared with a national average of 34%, 58% in the northeast, and parents also in the northeast and Northern Ireland apparently lacking confidence the most with 79%. That's a phenomenally high figure.
I was actually shocked with the eczema rates, because we come from a family, Harry's side of the family, there's very much asthma and eczema, and actually Aveeno is something that we've used all the way through the family, and they've just brought out this kind of new range, Domexa range, which is specifically for eczema, which has been so reassuring for me for soothing my little ones, because they just, it's so uncomfortable. It's like this sort of silent...
As I say, I've got to say that it sounds probably like a great punk band, Asthma and Eczema, you know. But, you know, McFly was a better choice, I have to say. You know, you do.
I know, and we are... I'm going to blame Harry completely for the eczema.
Well, yeah.
Indeed.
Ben Lewis in the studio here. Ben, any thoughts you've been listening to what Izzy's been talking about? Any thoughts of yourself?
Yeah, definitely. Like you both, I think the statistics are incredibly high for what I, well, originally thought they would be, if I'm honest with you. But I was thinking, obviously, social media is now a new sort of concept within, you know, mother care, I'd say. But would you think traditionally sort of antenatal classes, things like that, where there was that kind of support group of people around you, would you say they're also, you know, still quite relevant now? Or would you say social media is now sort of taking over that?
I think you make, like, such a relevant point, because there are times where I think there's sort of, I suppose, when you're on social media, you're sort of anonymous, aren't you? So you're able to talk to a community of women and gain support from each other. But there have been times where I've really thought, actually, you know, are we talking to our friends? Are we going to our mums? Because they're the ones that have lots of knowledge, especially, you know, mothers and grandparents and everything else. And I think that's where social media can slightly cloud that. And as you say, I mean, I was, I had an NCT group, and we'd be WhatsApping all through the night. you know, kind of help, what do I do? So I think it's just striking a balance, isn't it, and being able to make sure that we make the best of everything and we don't look at social media and put pressure on ourselves for this sort of idealistic, perfect family life, because we all know that that's not realistic. We all have tough days.
Sounds absolutely awesome. I just had this notion that 21st century mums actually WhatsApping us that the waters are breaking, hashtag excited, and oh, lords.
But you know, when it was the middle of the night and I was up with Lola and especially Kit, who had terrible like reflux, and just, you know, you can feel so isolated with a new baby. And I think it's anywhere that you can get that support or just reassurance is so valuable.
Izzy, it's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with your good self today. The pressure continues, though, because I'm going to ask you to make a selection of a range of possible tunes to see us into the next segment. I'll Be Okay, Sorry Is Not Good Enough, obviously, All About You, That Girl, Star Girl. You can see where we're going here.
I can see where you're going.
Exactly.
You got my little girl's favourite, which is Daddy's song, which is Love Is On The Radio, which would be the most appropriate?
Do you know, we have indeed got Love Is On The Radio. Just for yourself, Izzy, it's lined up and sorted out for routine. So two final questions. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on Siren Radio this morning? Has it been okay for you?
I have loved it. Thank you, Alex and Ben. Thank you for having me.
And actually, we need to mention, if people are interested or want to follow up on this, would you suggest the best place to go would be the Aveeno website? That's A-V-E-E-N-O.
Aveeno, yes. And also Boots have got a lot of information, especially about their new range, the new Domexa range, which is specifically for eczema prone.
Brilliant. And I take it, Izzy, you might be able to return in the not-too-distant future and keep us appraised of how life in the McFly household is continuing. I didn't like in the McFly household. You see what I did there? It's just Harry. It's just Harry. It's not like the whole band.
It's the whole band. You don't want to live under one roof.
He's far too busy dancing around the country at the moment.
Well, this is true. Exactly so.
Ripping it up all over the place.
Well, in fact, I tell you what. Hopefully you'd be kind enough to return, but would you like to dedicate this next one, obviously from your daughters, to their daddy, etc.? Off you go. Love Is On The Radio, McFly. Take care now.
On the radio. Love is 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 on the radio.
around each other. Things are looking up, looking up. There's magic everywhere you go. Strangers stop to say hello. Hello, hello, hello. So turn it up, turn it up. As loud as you can make it go. Play it till your speakers blow. And listen till your ears explode.
Life, heading abroad, and effectively sort of saying, that's it, that's where we're going, we're going to chase a whole new life in the sun. Well, maybe it's not going to be all that it's cracked up to be, and maybe to actually address this in a fictional narrative, who better than the author of Four American Tales, the awesome writer, and indeed freelance editor, author of several Berlitz travel guides, it's the amazingly talented Jack Messenger. How are you, Jack?
Very well indeed. Thank you very much for that lovely introduction, Alex.
Delighted to connect with your good self today, Jack. But this particular story, which obviously ties in with Farewell Olympus, quite intriguing, actually, that maybe actually chasing the sun isn't the best way forward for people. Maybe the grass isn't always green on the other side.
Well, that's what I tend to think, having spent 10 years in France, which I enjoyed very much indeed. You do begin to appreciate your own country when you go abroad and all the wonderful things that it has. And recently, of course, with the weather being so wonderful, people are thinking twice about settling elsewhere or even going on holiday elsewhere.
Indeed, recent straw poll, 500 UK adults found that the overwhelming majority, 94%, had fantasised about emigrating and so on. I wonder if that'll increase post-Brexit talks. It's a different thought there.
Yes, it's difficult to predict, isn't it?
Well, who knows? But from your own perspective, as somebody who's lived in France and obviously had the experience from that point of view, I must admit, when I saw the title Farewell Olympus, I thought, oh, are we going to be talking about the Greek gods, Zeus, etc.? It's nothing like to do with that at all, really.
No, it isn't really, no. My character, central character, is a young man who lives in Paris and who's been lent a very, very luxurious penthouse apartment from which he plans to foster his career. He's an Englishman, and he speaks French very well, but he still encounters difficulties communicating with other people and gets involved in a rather farcical mystery. And it's not based on my experience, of course, but it is inspired by it, because there are a lot of miscommunications, even when you do speak another language, some of which are rather embarrassing, and some of which, where you mean to pay a compliment to someone, you end up insulting them. So that's how it's turned out.
Witty, intriguing, and even a little poignant rivalry of and family tensions, literally spiced with romance and mystery. It sounds like the ideal unputdownable holiday book, Jack.
Well, I hope so, yes. I think it is. But, of course, I would say that, wouldn't I?
I don't know, with a line of dash of mystery and a soupçon of garlic, that takes a whole range of things from that perspective.
Yes.
I mean, we are, as human beings, creatures of narrative. We love our stories and so on. But also, there is this peculiar notion of the British folk abroad. Whereas you've just alluded to, sometimes it's felt that as long as we speak slowly and clearly and quite loudly, everybody will understand us.
Yes, of course. And of course, they invariably do, because English is a global language now, and so many people speak it. So we're very, very lucky. But one of the surprising outcomes of the straw poll we did is that people aren't particularly interested in learning another culture or another language. They want to go somewhere that's very sunny, where the life is a little bit easier than it is at home. And they want to have English food, and they want to have English people around them. So I guess, like all emigrant communities, people tend to stick together and stay with what they know. But I was surprised that so few people wanted to speak a foreign language.
It's interesting that those of us of a certain age can remember the joys of Passport to Pimlico and the notions of the Burgundians from that point of view.
Yes, I recognise that film.
There you go. You see, if you're confused or you're listening to this, well, check it out on YouTube or something. It's an outstanding piece. But in terms of Burgundy, that is one area which clearly has got a lot of history that connects us together from that point of view. And do you feel that actually, you know, including the Channel Tunnel, etc., there are closer similarities between Burgundy and France and Britain than sometimes we like to make out?
I think there are, yes. It's a hard thing to do, really, to live for any length of time in another country because, say, with a country like France, there are a great many similarities, of course, between that country and ours. But it's the little subtle differences that trip you up. So, for example, you can say what you think is going to be a compliment, and it can be interpreted as an insult. And there are very practical differences as well. For example, if you're driving along a main road and then a combine harvester or a tractor appears on your right-hand side wanting to join that road, you have to give way. And people just insist on their rights and pull out in these huge vehicles, and you have to brake like mad. It's, you know, my life flashed before my eyes a number of times. It's very, very confusing.
Well, I suppose it's the return aspect of karma, because if you're an American and you actually came over to Britain and you'd actually encounter the joys of the roundabout, that's a whole new sort of feeling. So maybe it's just a case of, say, karmic satisfaction there.
Yes, a bit of revenge.
Bringing us neatly round to Four American Tales, worth mentioning, a quartet of evocative stories about love and loss, struggle and ambition from the 1950s to the present day. That's clearly the other side of the Atlantic. Any kind of similarities or any thoughts that you kind of crossed over in terms of Farewell, Olympus as well, from that perspective? Or is it a case of ultimately stories are about people?
Yes, I think so. Stories are about people, definitely. As you just mentioned, we have a great need for stories, narratives, right from the very, very beginnings of humanity. We need to make sense of the world and ourselves and interpret ourselves to others. So I think in our humble way, writers do a good thing. They entertain us, if we're lucky, and they teach us about ourselves as well. And that was my hope in these Four American Tales, which are very, very different from Farewell Olympus. Much more genre-based, based around crime and other things like that. So quite a variety.
jackmessenger.co.uk is an awesome website to go to. I'm intrigued by the notion of jackmessenger/feedthemonkey, but perhaps we should talk about that another time.
Yes.
Another line of things. Are there any other websites that you suggest people should go to if they want to get hold of a copy, obviously, of Farewell Olympus, or it's a case of it's available through all the usual online retailers?
That's the case indeed, yes. Anywhere you go online, you will find it.
Well, Jack, it's been wonderful just sharing some thoughts with your good self today. We've got two final questions for your good self. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
Yes, it's gone very well indeed. Thank you, yes.
And in which case can we then prevail upon you to hopefully join us again in the not-too-distant future? And who knows, joining one of the book festivals that we've got either in Lincoln or Newark in the not-too-distant future, will you be kind enough to return?
Yes, indeed. That would be very, 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 very interesting. Thank you very much indeed for the invitation.
Jack Messenger, author extraordinaire. Many thanks. Take care.
Thank you, Alex. Bye-bye.
Songs of Prosperity and Happiness, Sacred Spirit from the Native American group. And I'm sure Randy Reinholtz, our regular correspondent from San Diego University, would appreciate that. But finally, after all sorts of wonderful suggestions, we're delighted to welcome the Chancellor of the University of Lincoln, an awesome individual who has been with us for a number of years here at Lincoln, the fantastically talented, amazingly wonderful, awesome soul that is Lord Victor Adebowale, CBE. Good morning, Victor. How are you?
Hello, Victor will do nicely. Exactly. I've not been described as awesome by anybody.
Well,
oh, there you go.
I listened to the first time you were behind the desk here at Siren Radio, Victor, and that was impressive itself. I mean, Angela Rippon still shares the tale of the connections with you, so I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Yeah, it's great stuff.
That's very flattering.
It's only,
that was fun.
Absolutely right, and it'll only be a matter of time before you become a regular. I was already saying to Ellie Sample, we need to draft the jingles for you and the idents from that point of view.
I'd love that. Yeah. It's always been my ambition. Cool.
Well, I think so. And now, of course, there is still technically an opening for the BBC Radio 2 breakfast morning slot. Now Chris Evans has moved.
You can apply for that one. You can apply for that one.
It's a definite thought. Now, what I'd like to share with you, and by the way, I also introduce you, Victor, to Ben Lewis, who's one of our final year public relations students here.
Good morning.
Hi, Ben. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm all right, yeah. I'm actually walking through Oxford Circus.
Oh, excellent.
On my way to the King's Fund at the moment, so if you hear any background noise, that's what it is.
That's always wondering where you were. We did hear some traffic lights.
Yeah.
I thought it might have been...
I'm walking through London.
Yeah, or a sound effects tape that's in the background. Yeah. We don't know.
Yeah.
Ben, as a student of the university of which Victor is Chancellor of, what sort of thoughts would you like to say? This is a rare and privileged time, what would you say?
Yeah, certainly. So I know a bit about you anyway, but for any students listening who...
nothing
incriminating.
I promise,
nothing bad. For students and any listeners out there who perhaps don't, how about you tell us a little bit about your role with the university and perhaps what you do outside university as well?
Well, my role in the university, it's one of those lovely sinecures, actually, because it's very rare. You can hear, you know, I'm in London.
It's a raid. Exactly.
That's the song of London. I can assure you that's nothing to do with me. So the role of Chancellor is really representational. I mean, it's great because as a student of organisational psychology, I get to watch things, but I'm not responsible for much. I chair the council, the university's council, which is a kind of an organising body of the good and the great in support of the university and raises funds for the university and reviews the university's progress. I act as counsel, I suppose, and a counsel in the old-fashioned word to the vice-chancellor if she's got things she wants to talk about. I'm a supporter. And I attend bless the giving of graduation certificates and graduations and nod, like a nodding dog, as people walk past me at the formal process of receiving entry to the wonderful world of graduation, amongst other things. I also represent the university at events, sometimes in London. I work with the Vice Chancellor when she wants to promote the university. Particularly in London.
I think in many ways...
Some events at the House of Lords.
It's the dream team in many ways. Professor Mary Stewart and Lord Victor Adebowale. It's fantastic. It's genius stuff there.
She's all the work.
We'll pass that on to her from that perspective. It's all great from that. Awarded the CBE, obviously, for services to the New Deal, the Unemployed and Homeless Young People in 2000, Non-Executive Director of NHS England, Commissioner of the UK Commission for Employment and Skills, and on the boards of locality... How do you think... Because we were talking earlier in the production about coordinating things, and we had a professor from Oxford who was saying, you need more technology to organise your life. Many people would say... Just make a list.
Well, I mean, first of all, I need to update my CV because I'm really bad at, updating things. So some of those things you mentioned, I'm no longer involved in. Uh-huh. They've still got but I haven't updated it. So the United Kingdom Commission for Employment and Skills, I left some years ago. I mean, the thing is, it looks busy, but actually it's all aligned around my work with Turning Point and my role as a member of the House of Lords. So it's not as though I'm running around doing different things. Turning Point is a health and social care social enterprise, and being a board member of NHS England is not only, hopefully, useful for NHS England, but it's also very useful for my role as chief executive. Turning Point, it gives you a view of the future. And actually, being Chancellor of a university and a visiting professor, although it's a privilege, also, we are working with Lincoln on some bids for services. And, of course, Lincoln does have a health and social care, many health and social care courses, and we do employ and have employed graduates from Lincoln University. So it's kind of, there's a theme to what I do. It's not just random. I have great people who support me. I'm stuffed, basically, without the people that work with me.
We worked through it. Now, it's the start of the new academic year, Victor. Clearly, we're just in the midst of the excitement of Freshers Week. I'll be welcoming back the second and third years to the Communications and Public Relations courses. I know this is a little bit, and who would have thought, talk about random, being asking the Chancellor of the University whilst he's at the House of Lords to give a kind of inspirational message for the start of the year. Could be more random. Yeah. Any thoughts that you'd like to share with the student, the listener, or indeed the citizens of Lincoln at this stage?
Oh God! Well, I don't know about the citizens of Lincoln.
They're waiting. They're waiting with eager breath here.
To our students, I should say that you are hardworking and lucky. Never forget how lucky you are, because you're human. And to the second years coming back, I would say keep calm and carry on. You are on your way. To the new entrants to Lincoln, I would say you are. You've made the right choice. We are a university, and it's not just me saying that, that's evidence-based, as it should be, an academic institution. You are entering one of the best universities in the country to be a student, and if you're going to be a student, go to a university that actually gives a damn about you, and Lincoln certainly does. And I would say that you are the fuel for the future, not only of this country, but for the world, and don't forget that, because my future and the future of all the people in Lincoln will rely to a large extent on what you do next, on what you do, where you work, what you think, and what your values are. And to the people of Lincoln, I would simply say, good morning. It's really, really nice to be the Chancellor of your university.
Ben, any thoughts or questions you'd like to sort of raise at this stage? Do you feel inspired as a third year, as a returning third year?
I do indeed. It's and I agree with you. It is a brilliant university. It's not something I have any regrets about joining here. It's it's worked out really well for me. And you know, obviously, it was quite a big move coming up from Brighton. But it's
you came via the Red Arrows, I believe, Ben.
Yes, and that was one of the biggest links for me. But it's for me personally, though.
Red Arrows.
Yeah,
I think you need to expand on that
one,
really.
Exactly.
It was my first work experience placement, and I ended up coming up to Scampton to do it, RF Scampton.
All right.
And through that, one of the gentlemen who works in there happened to come to University of Lincoln many moons ago and asked if I wanted to go to an open day. So I went to an open day and it went from there, really.
And several years later, he's co-hosting the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. It just goes to show.
Gosh, that's something. You've made it to the third year. It's certainly not a coast home, but you know you can do it.
Exactly.
So I'm expecting a first.
Thank you. No pressure there.
No pressure. But how many students get the chance at the university?
So there,
none at all. But
and the world certainly needs good public relations right now.
Indeed, it depends where you're talking about specifically, I suppose. But it's done really well for me here, not just as a university, but as a city as well. I think it's not just reassuring for me, but reassuring for my family as well, who come to visit and absolutely love the place. And you're proud to take people around.
Well, people are blown away, aren't they? And when they come to the city, particularly to the graduation ceremonies, I often sit there on the stage and see some of our students, actually, and their parents and supporters, open-mouthed at the sheer grandeur of the place. There was a wonderful, I wish I could take a picture of the Chinese student at the last graduation ceremony. He was literally in awe, looking around. with a WTF look on his face, and it was quite a it is a stunning place to be. I think people are very privileged to be there.
Indeed. Well, as I said before, it's nip and tuck. I mean, as a graduate of the University of London, I had the Albert Hall experience, but in many ways, possibly...
Yeah,
nothing.
No. Nothing. Not even close.
No. There you go. Exactly. It's sort of
not even
that.
Close, baby.
Precisely. It's been, as I knew it would be, an absolutely splendid chance to actually feature your good self. I know we've spoken with Ellie for several months about getting you back on the programme. So we've got two final questions. There are customer satisfaction ones, really. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us this morning, Lord Adebowale?
Have I had a lot with you?
Have you had a reasonably interesting link? Has it been okay for you?
It's been great, yeah.
Nice, this is good.
Fantastic, actually. I'm impressed it's all worked. I mean, the wonders of modern technology. I mean, I'm standing in the open outside the King's Fund having a chat with people in Lincoln, and you're very friendly.
Well, brings it all together.
I mean, well, last night we were connecting Cannes, Los Angeles, and London, and Scotland, and Edinburgh. So, you know, just motoring.
Worldwide link.
Exactly.
Congratulations to your engineers there.
Well... So can we prevail upon your good self to join us again? I'm already working on getting a plaque put in the studio, which I'm sure I'll run past Andrew saying Lord Victor Adebowale has...
Well, we need to get one of those blue plates,
yes,
don't we? Like,
I think so.
English Heritage plate.
Just a simple piece of paper with Vic was here would be great. I'm up for it. I really enjoy the radio, and I really enjoy my attempt at a show, so I'd be up for doing it again. It was great fun.
Victor, we look forward to a round of applause for Lord Victor Adebowale, CBE.
Vic will do. Speak to you soon.
Beloved, and the sun rising. It's time for the Roll of Honour. We thank the awesome Stephanie Romashevsky, Richard Fitzwilliams, and Ian Lennox, Dr. Sarah Jarvis, Jack Messenger, and further on from that, of course, Izzy Judd, and Professor Marmadro. You see, you don't know the exact. Just waiting for that, just teasing that from the University of Oxford, of course, and our very own Chancellor of the University of Lincoln, the home of Siren Radio, of course, Lord Victor Adebowale, CBE. Vic was here. Outstanding. Let's say thank you as well to Ellie Sample. Ellie had to head off to sort out Magical Things, otherwise she would have stayed for the whole system. Maybe it was because she didn't like the coffee you brought her.
Exactly.
It was a polite reason. She saw the coffee and she thought, no, I've got to leave. I
promise you, I've done nothing to it.
Take any more. Ben, have you enjoyed being back on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition?
Yes, it's been very good, thank you. Very good.
So we'll do it again next week for Midweek Drive Morning Edition.
Yes.
Yeah, I think we should.
Perfect.
Up at 7 o'clock this evening. Of course, there are lots of other things coming up between now and then, including Drive Time with Chris Clarkson. But at 7 o'clock, it's The Stone Tapes, Volume 40.
Yep. Interesting.
Comes of Age with Sam Stone and David J. Howe, plus lots of great music during the course of the day. That's it for the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. We're out of here to continue our welcome week duties and more. Have a splendid day. Gabriella Peralta, get well very soon. Phil Leonis, hopefully you're around and okay in Los Angeles, and we'll speak with you next week. And who else? Oh yes, happy birthday to Lula Randall. Fantastic. That's it then. Keep on keeping on. Shall we just say farewell?
We say farewell. We did French last night.
We did French. So auf Wiedersehen?
Auf Wiedersehen.
Okay. A one, two, three.
Auf Wiedersehen.